there, everybody. It is Thursday, December 20th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us, drop us an email, and send that on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What an amazing show we have for you this week. It is time to get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
Then let me introduce you. Andrew Solomon is a writer and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology. In 1988, he published The Irony Tower. In 1994, he wrote A Stone Boat, a national bestseller. His award-winning contributions to The New York Times, The New Yorker, Newsweek, and The Advocate, just to name a few, have covered the gamut from depression to Soviet artists to gay marriage. His 2001 book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, won the 2001 National Book Award for Nonfiction, was a finalist for the 2002 Pulitzer Prize, and was included in the Times of London's list of 100 best books of the decade. That text was a New York Times bestseller in both hardcover and paperback. It's won more accolades than I could possibly even begin to describe. His newest book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, in my hands right this second, was already named one of the 10 best books of 2012 by the New York Times. If I actually gave him the introduction he deserves, we would have no time to chat. So, Mr. Solomon, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
What a pleasure to be here.
It's a lot of accolades, sir.
Yes, I rather like chalking them up.
That's a long resume you have there, but we have so much to talk about. Are you ready?
I'm ready if you are.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't start with the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. You've been on CNN, The Today Show. You've chatted with Diane Sawyer. What is it that you set out to get across in that short bit of airtime that they give you?
Well, I, in the course of writing my current book, Far From the Tree, have a chapter on families of people who commit crimes. And so I went and interviewed a lot of those families, and I interviewed, among others, the parents of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine Massacre.
Yes.
And I went off to see them thinking that if I got to know them, I would understand how things had worked out that way in their household and why this had happened. And the better I got to know them, the more mystified I was. They're lovely, decent, kind, moral people, and they produced somehow a child who was capable of this disaster. What I felt in looking at Dylan's writings and in talking to them was that Dylan suffered from a great deal of depression, and that in the mode of many adolescents who suffer from depression, some of it was evidenced in destructive behavior toward others. In this case, very extreme destructive behavior, but still it was within a pattern. And so looking at what's happened at Newtown and trying to understand the murder-suicide which took place, all of the media interest right now is on the murder, and the murder is the thing that's most devastating. I mean, everyone has the right to commit suicide, and the idea of shooting up a classroom of little kids is horrifying. But I think that if you really want to understand where these problems come from, that you have to be open to the idea that they really originate in suicide and despair.
Well, please tell me if this runs contrary to what you felt doing these interviews, but in watching you on the Today Show on CNN, I feel like there's almost this sense of desperation from the media on behalf of their viewers for insight that would make it all make sense. And they turn to you for some answers. That's just what the impression that I get in watching these. Do you feel that when you're sitting there in the chair?
I feel it all the time.
Yeah.
And I feel as though I have to disappoint them because I have to be honest in my experience. What everyone really wants is for someone to say, this is caused by poor parenting.
Right.
And if you at home are taking care of your children in a better way and aren't doing the bad things that these problematical parents did, then this isn't going to happen and your children are obviously the sweet people they appear to be and are completely incapable of doing this. I have kids. I adore my kids. They've never shown me any particular sign of malice, so they can be fractious from time to time. But having gone through this whole experience, I feel like people keep secrets. People are very good at keeping secrets.
Right.
And you only know as much as you know, and you may be very surprised. You may be gloriously surprised by your child doing extraordinary and wonderful things you never imagined, but you may also be surprised by horror. It's simply, it's there in the air.
So what you're saying is you do not have all the answers to parenting?
But sadly, I don't know. If you do, please get back to me and let me know what they are.
That's the next book. That's the next book. Well, let's talk about you as a writer. You cannot read an article or book or reflection that you have penned and not just feel this immense appreciation for the written word. How would you describe your relationship to expressing yourself through writing?
You know, friends of my parents are always coming up to me and saying, I remember when you were 2 years old and you said you were going to be a writer, and look, here it is, and you are. And I sort of feel as though it's the one thing that was always clear to me. I was a little vague for a while about, I don't know, my sexuality, my nationality, about all kinds of other things, but I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. And I have the advantage, I think, of not being very good at anything else. So it's sort of my default mode.
I was going to ask, the next question was, what is your earliest memory of writing something and you realizing yourself, hey, I'm pretty good at this?
Well, I mean, I still have some days when I think that and some days when I think the exact opposite. But I always loved, I mean, I used to, I don't know, when I was little, on weekends in the summer, I would empty the dishwasher because I tended to wake up, or I rather tended to stay up late, and I would empty the dishwasher before I went to bed, and I would write little poems about the dishes that I would leave on the kitchen table. My mother, being not a particularly sentimental person, didn't save very much.
Oh, that's a shame.
There's only one that has survived, which was... it just sounds too ridiculous and pathetic to go into writing poems about the dishwasher. But in any event, I was always doing things like that. I was always finding little things that interested me. And I loved words, and my father read to me all the time, and I felt as though language was very... It just seemed to me to be the center of everything that we did and of how we lived. I loved it. And I loved when other people could express things beautifully. When I was little, one of my favorite books was The Rutabaga Stories by Carl Sandburg.
Yes, of course.
Many children find them too strange and are made uncomfortable by them. And my younger brother, who's quite literate in his own way, was not particularly engaged by them. But I loved the sort of the sheer scale of imagination that they entail.
I love the idea of your next piece in, say, The New Yorker being Ode to the Dishwasher and the rest of the country trying to figure out what the metaphor is. And I know that it's not a metaphor.
I was some years ago invited to a concert that was given with great fanfare in New York, at which people heard Richard Wagner's Juvenalia. And at the end of the concert, I said, there is a reason why one does not generally wish to hear people's Juvenalia.
I still hold out hope for that day, so I'm just putting that out there right now. Well, we must turn our attention to Far From the Tree. Is it fair to say, sir, that the process of putting this book together perhaps took more than a few hours?
It was the most overwhelming thing that I've ever done, and I spent much of the time while I was working on it thinking not simply that I couldn't do it, but that it was undoable, that it would never be possible to get through all the material, and it would never be possible to finish the book. And I still sometimes wake up and have to look at a copy of it sitting on my desk and think, one way or another, there it is between hardcovers.
Well, talk to our listeners. I mean, we have our listeners write in all the time who say, look, we want to do what your guests are doing. And certainly any number of writers who have that colossal project in front of them and somehow get deterred. What advice do you have to give to get them through that? Perhaps, you know, maybe it's not a decade-long project like yours, but how do you get through those moments of thinking, this is undoable?
Well, partly I think one tends to feel things are undoable when one looks at a macro level, and then you go back to the micro level and you think, okay, the book may be undoable, but I can actually write this little section about this particular person and their experience. And so you do it in a mosaic, in effect. You do it in all of these little bits and pieces. And also I think sometimes you have to be working on something else for a little while and then return to it and be newly overcome with a sense of interest in what it is that you're writing about so that it doesn't come to feel only oppressive. But the book is really, it's many things, but at some basic level, it's a collection of stories about people, and it's about people whom I went out and met and interviewed all over this country and some of them abroad as well. And I really like people, and I really wanted to do justice to their stories, and I think that was motivating even when my own obligation to get it written felt burdensome.
Now, did it end up in a different place than its genesis? The kernel of an idea that you had when you started, did it start out someplace completely different?
It started out someplace somewhat different, and then it shifted. I'm always amused that you sell nonfiction books on the basis of a proposal, because I've always said, if you could tell at the time that you were writing the proposal what you were going to say in the book, then you wouldn't actually need to go out and research the book.
Oh, that's a triviality.
It always shifts around a lot. The scale of it grew enormously. The scale of the questions I was asking grew enormously. I'd started off with the idea, I wrote 20 years ago a piece for the Times Magazine about the deaf and deaf culture. And when I was assigned the piece, I had no awareness of, interest in, focus on deaf culture. Mm-hmm. And then I got into the deaf world, and I went to the Miss Deaf America contest, and I went to the National Association of the Deaf, and I saw deaf theater and deaf poetry and so on and so forth. And I thought, okay, this is not my culture, but it is a culture, and right. It is a perfectly valid culture. And I thought, how do I compare the experience of all of these deaf people to experiences I've had? And I discovered that most deaf people are born to hearing parents, that they discover a sense of cultural identity often in adolescence from a peer group, and that they then often are highly liberated by it, and their parents have to come to terms with who their child really is. And I said that to me it was unbelievably close to the gay experience. It was certainly close to my gay experience. Mm-hmm. And I saw this parallel, and then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf, and suddenly she started saying, do I tell her she's just like everyone else, only kind of short? Do I have to join the Little People of America and go to conferences? What are the best ways for me to deal with having this child who is a dwarf? And so when she started asking those questions, and I found out that most dwarfs are burned parents of average height, I then sort of thought, well, here it is again. You have this family that perceives itself at some level to be normal, with a child they perceive at some level to be abnormal, and then the child finds community, and then the parents have to come to terms with that. And that was what I had when I started out. Then as I went on, these sort of larger issues of what is illness and what is identity and what are the conditions, the many conditions that actually can be looked at through this lens, and the idea that the kind of corollary to the queer experience is that actually everything is an illness and everything is an identity, and we don't need to say which things are illnesses and which are identities. It's reductive to do so. All of that kind of came together as I went forward. And, of course, I then had to become very expert in lots of different areas. You know, right. I had to understand the genetics of autism and the social policies involved in the deinstitutionalization of people with schizophrenia, and what the hormonal protocols are for people who are transgender, and how early musical genius is related to later musical accomplishment, and right. so on and so forth. So it broadened and broadened and broadened and broadened.
Well, as I was reading through, and I'm reading just the content that you were able to get from these families, you spoke to so many different families. This goes beyond just being a writer. Once you had access to these families, what did you do to establish connections that yielded such rich content?
You know, my grandmother was one of those people who would sit down on the crosstown bus, and total strangers would inexplicably sit down next to her and start telling her their life stories. And I think I inherited a little bit of that. But I also think that the people who I interviewed, by and large, described having been very lonely in the experiences that they had had. And one after the next, they said to me, if my doing this with you will allow others to feel less lonely in their experience than I felt when I had my experience, then even though this is a painful and difficult topic for me, I'm going to sit down and give it my best shot, because I would love for what I went through to help somebody else. And I think that was the engine of it. You know, I think some of them seem to like me, and some of them have become good friends, and that all of that plays into it. But I also think I had some feeling of purposefulness in doing it, and the people I interviewed had purposefulness in being involved in it.
Even right now, I want to tell you my life story.
Please do.
I'm just saying, you seem to have inherited it. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Well, given that you're appearing on this show, So Gay, I had intended to focus on that first chapter, Son, where you talked about your own identity, and the transgender chapter, and I'm still going to do that. But it strikes me that as I was processing all this, doing it that way goes against kind of the inherent kinship and the intersectionality that you do so well to put forth in the text. How much of that kinship with other identities did you feel before you wrote Far From the Tree, and how much did you establish in the process?
I would say I felt Zippo before I wrote Far From the Tree, and that when I started working on the book, I began to feel that there were all of these experiences which on the surface sounded as though they must be very different from my experience, but in point of fact were not so different from my experience. And as I went forward, I thought, you can't have partial justice. It's not an effective structure.
Right.
You have to either say, we honor and accept people's right to be different in the ways that they have defined for themselves, with obvious exceptions where people, I mean, we can't sort of say it's really just fine to be a brutal gang member. And
right.
I wrote in the introduction about the problems with the pro-anorexia movement.
Yes.
And so on and so forth. But I think at some larger level, you can say that we're all in this fight together, that if we want to see racial justice, we also need to see justice for people of non-traditional sexualities. We also need to see justice for families that are constructed in whatever way people choose to construct their families, and we need to see justice for people who have got disabilities and challenges and so on and so forth. I just ended up feeling as though the revelation of the book really was, wow, I thought I had something in common with other people who had had my experience, other people who had grown up gay or who had grown up with various other bits of identity mm-hmm. that I have. And I ended up thinking, these people who look to me like they couldn't be more foreign to me have had experiences that closely resemble mine, and we have a lot to say to one another.
Well, you write in the book, you write, quote, "Married families learn to tolerate, accept, and finally celebrate children who are not what they originally had in mind. This transformative process is often eased and sometimes confounded by identity politics and medical progress, both of which have infiltrated households to a degree that would have been inconceivable even 20 years ago." I was fascinated by all the threads throughout the book that this is ever evolving, this idea of identity politics and how families interact with their children who have different identities. How much of that generational aspect to all of this were you able to put your fingers on?
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm very much a product of my own generation, and that, you know, the life that I have with a husband and kids was unimaginable when I was growing up.
Right.
And the central question of the book, I suppose, I keep saying the central question, but I think this really is the central question, is how can you possibly have something that changes from being so universally seen as a crime and illness and a sin to living in a society in which the President of the United States has come out in favor of gay marriage.
Right.
And if you accept that you can have that kind of change there, and if you accept that for most people in 1969, when Time magazine described gayness as a pernicious sickness and a second-rate substitute for reality deserving of no glamorization, if you think that that was the mainstream view and that the mainstream view, you know, has shifted so dramatically, where else can it shift? And you have to be open to the idea, you know, you think, ah, but I would have been enlightened about gay people even then. But perhaps if you were gay, you would have been. Perhaps you wouldn't have been so enlightened even then. And
right.
My theory was just, all of this is fluid. All of it is constantly changing. All of what we think of as being acceptable or shocking is in a state of flux. So that was what I wanted to look at there.
Well, let's turn for a second to the transgender chapter, which was riveting. And as we say so often on this show, we don't do nearly enough justice to covering the T in LGBT as we talk about issues in the media. Am I correct in reading that you serve on the board of directors of Trans Youth Allies?
Trans Youth Family Allies.
The Trans Youth Family Allies with our great friend Andrea James, who was recently on the show. And by the way, did I also read that they had you pegged as the secretary?
You know, they did have me pegged at the secretary at one point, which I really wanted to do. It's an amazing organization, and I could not believe more emphatically in everything that the organization does. I have been in the midst of finishing this book, so I have not been very effective as a secretary.
But the secretary, they couldn't break you out of the box and make you the treasurer or something that didn't have to do with writing? I feel there was some embracing of stereotypes there. I just want to put that out there. I'm a little worried, but I was thinking they could have given you another role.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Now, so obviously you have great familiarity. You've worked with the trans community in doing this board work. How much did you learn in challenging your own preconceptions or stereotypes in talking to families with trans children?
I have strong counterphobic tendencies, so I tend to rush toward things that I find very frightening as the best way of managing to get through them.
Okay.
And one of the things that I was doing in this book really was writing about a lot of things that made me uncomfortable. I was not very comfortable with people with severe disabilities. Mm-hmm. I was not very comfortable with people in many of the categories that that appear in the book. I thought when I started on the book that trans was a kind of interesting area, and that as with, for example, autism or Down syndrome, was something I would learn a lot about, and I might get to know some amazing people in the process, and I didn't see it as having any particular relevance to me. And then as I started spending time with people who are trans and recognizing the level of hatred and prejudice that was directed against them, I was completely shocked by it. It was something, I mean, I suppose I'd vaguely read some reports here and there, but I had no sense of how vigorous it was. And as I looked at it, I thought, oh, I was, like so many of us, bullied as a child. And when I was a child, I was not being bullied for my sexuality, which I had certainly not yet conceptualized, much less acted on. I was being bullied because I varied in some ways from traditional gender norms. I was that weird kid who was bad at sports and listened to opera. And so I thought the experience that these trans people are having of being treated so hatefully is actually quite close to some of the experience that I myself have had. And that was a revelation to me. Yeah. And when I came to that understanding, I then suddenly felt a sense of real kinship with these people who had seemed sort of, you know, strange and somewhat freakish beforehand to me. And now I have quite a lot of trans friends who I've got to know. And it's, I mean, part of what I hope the book will do for readers is what it certainly did for me, which is to serve as a really strong normalizing force to make things that seem to be unimaginable, imaginable. And so that's been the great journey of that chapter, is that I really, you know, I was not living the tea, and now I just think, well, of course, it's all, and I feel like there's this problematical thing, which is very highly politicized, which is that we have to say that gay people and trans people are different, and you shouldn't conflate the stories of gay people with the stories of trans people, because your gender identity is different from your sexuality,
right.
And that's all true. But on the other hand, most gay people have also got some issues that have got to do with their gender expression,
yeah.
And there are many people who are not trans, but whose gender expression is somehow aberrant, and it ends up being the thing that determines how they're treated throughout life. And the experience of a boy who's very effeminate, or indeed a girl who's very masculine, but certainly a boy who's very effeminate, is different from the experience of the captain of the football team who happens to like having sex with other guys.
Yeah.
And as I worked on the trans thing, I just sort of thought, okay, these really are our brothers and sisters, as one says in the cliched phrase.
Well, you take it a step further, and this is just one of my favorite parts about the whole text. You take it one step further from normalizing, and you introduce right there at the start in the first chapter, Son, you introduce the concept of celebrating. And that's something that perhaps as a community that is constantly, you know, fighting for equal rights, we're not so great sometimes at the celebrating. And pausing to celebrate our identities. Is that something that you found people are responding to already?
Yes, I think actually a lot of people do celebrate their identities.
Yeah.
I think if you go back 20 or 30 years, it would have been harder to have a show called The Show.
Indeed. Indeed.
you know, I think we all end up taking, it's a famous acculturation process. We take the term of insult and make it into the nexus of our pride. It started with people who were in the kind of original Black Power movement, and it's continued in all kinds of other contexts since. And I think it's a very powerful process, and I think it's, you know, I think it's amazing and miraculous how much it happens. But part of what I then wanted to question was, okay, but then do you start celebrating everything about yourself? I mean, I don't know, I've got various unattractive qualities that I won't list here on the radio, but I don't feel that they all need to be celebrated, and I think people can get very carried away with that idea of celebration. On the other hand, I think if the people are trying to overcome the sense that they have been badly mistreated because of the qualities they have, that at that point the celebration becomes a way to sort of refill a vessel that has been drained empty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I was reading online, and I did not know this, so, you know, the New York Times and various publications gave a wonderful notice about your marriage some years back, and
oh, yeah.
The text that you wrote for your own ceremony is now in a law school book?
Oh, it was being used. I don't know that it's in a book, but it was being distributed and discussed in the law school at the University of Pennsylvania.
But I can't possibly imagine that you wrote it with that end goal in mind.
No, certainly not. But after we had been married, we were at a party talking to a professor who teaches there, and she was interested in the issue of gay marriage, and we said that we had written our own ceremony, and we were describing various parts of it, and she said, oh, a lot of this is exactly what I want the students to be able to understand about marriage. I don't think she was gay herself, but she was interested in the ways that we talked about how revelatory and precious to us that freedom was. And she was particularly interested in A Prayer for Families, which actually my husband mostly wrote, having had a good Catholic childhood and being better at prayers than I am.
Well, were I you, I would find out from this professor which day each semester she is covering that and they are reading it together, and I would show up there in the back of the class. Because that's just wonderful. Now, how are you feeling post, you've written so prolifically on gay marriage and the evolution. How are you feeling post November election where so much progress was made?
Oh, you know, I feel like the book that I've written is a book about celebrating identity and difference. And if I were trying to promote it in Romney's America with all of those initiatives having failed, I would be having a very, very, very different experience of life. I just felt joyful at that election, and I had felt before I went into it, I kept thinking, okay, but how joyful will I be if Obama wins but all four measures fail? Well, okay, how joyful would I be if three measures pass but Obama doesn't get in and the Congress, you know, I kept imagining all of these different variants and thinking none of them were that great. And it's not that often that there's an election, especially in a time of so much turmoil in the world of finance where everything seems to go the way that you more or less wanted it to. I mean, not every single small election, but I felt it was joyful. And I'm also on the board of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force.
Yes.
And we've worked very hard on bringing about sort of some of those marriage initiatives and providing support for the ones that exist. And it was thrilling to see them surfacing.
Now, what do you have to say to our youth listeners? As you mentioned, you are on the board there at NGLTF, and we love having Ray Carey on the show, and we're always looking to inspire our young activists. We have so many youth listeners across the country that are looking for ways to get involved and are just not too sure how to put their stamp on making a difference in the fight for LGBT equality. What words of wisdom do you have?
Well, I would say that I have the experience now sometimes of talking to people who are sort of college age.
Yes.
And I did when I was at the Task Force Creating Change conference last year, and I spoke at it. And I'm so struck by how unbelievably different their perception of the world is from my perception of the world.
Right.
But I also, for various reasons, worked on stage with Larry Kramer. And so I got from him a very strong sense of how things felt from his side of things, Larry being, I don't know, 30 years older than I am or something like that. And the feeling I have is that if I had had to be gay when Larry Kramer was, I would have attempted suicide, as in fact Larry Kramer did.
Right.
And I might have ended up embittered and angry. And growing up when I did, I feel so lucky not to have had to go through what he went through. But I feel a sort of longing to think what it would have been like to grow up thinking, oh, yeah, well, if I meet the right guy, we'll get married and maybe we'll have kids. And, you know, it just was so unimaginable then. And my fervent hope is that those young people I was talking to will be at a conference 20 years from now, and they will be looking at the next generation and thinking, what would it be like to grow up with that sense of possibility? What would it be like to grow up not thinking, all right, I mean, gay people can't be president, obviously. Gay people can't do this. Gay people can't do that. You know, we'll never quite be treated equally under the law. What would it be like not to have any of those concerns? And my biggest hope is that when those people who are 20 years younger or 20 years older and go back, there won't be anything to talk about.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Well, we only have about a minute left, and we have to get to your song choices for this week's episode, because it's a very important part of our show where you, our guest, tell our listeners what some of your song choices say about you. It's a little self-analysis for our listening audience, and you had some quite fascinating song selections. Some I knew, some I did not. So let's just cover a couple of them real quick. What would you say that Earth, Wind, and Fire's song September says about you?
When I was growing up, I was one of those unhip kids who listened only to weird marginal music that no one else listened to. And other people listened to Earth, Wind, and Fire, and it was very cool, and I was not very cool, and I didn't listen to it. And when I was a lot older, I was someplace, and it was playing in the background, and I said, this is actually really kind of great music. And I thought, it's actually really cool and really fun. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, and I'm going to be belatedly cool now that it's not cool anymore. And when I write, I tend to listen obsessively to certain pieces of music over and over, and that was one of them. And the crowning glory in the moment when I decided that I really should do this was when we took our son to London, and we went to see the Changing of the Guard at Buckingham Palace.
Yes.
And the Royal Brass Band that is part of the changing process tends to put odd pieces of music in between the known classics, and there they were playing Earth, Wind, and Fire, September, and I thought, okay, I mean, it's a little less hackneyed than the Beatles. It's at least mildly amusing. So there it is.
That is fantastic. In 4 years, that's one of the best self-analysis we've had, but I'm going to make you do one more because I know how central opera is to your own identity. Susan Graham's Reynaldo Hahn, a chorus, which I did not know, and we will be playing at the end of the show. What does that particular selection say about you?
I love Susan Graham's voice, and my stepmother works in the field of opera, and so I've got to know a lot of singers, and she's one of the singers I've got to know. And Reynaldo Hahn was a composer who sort of had disappeared from many people's consciousness, and she recorded an album of his music and brought it back to life and did it so beautifully. And that song always feels to me as though it's full of, it's incredibly elegant, it's quite contained in its repeating rhythms and resonances, and yet it seems to me to be an expression of dignity and love, and there's a kind of perfect neoclassical beauty to it. And it makes me cry every time I listen to it, and I've listened to it about 1,000,007 times.
Well, I have to tell you, this text, Far From the Tree, if dignity and love applies to anything, it's just all throughout this text. Just the way that you validate identities and the very core way that you validate these people. Because this isn't just about issues and identity. These are about real people who are interacting with each other and have relationships and the dignity and love that you lend to their voices and that you then transmute to us, the readers, it's just a beautiful thing, sir.
Thank you. What a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
So anything coming up next that we need to know about? I would imagine you're going to be doing a lot of interviews talking about this text.
I'm doing lots of interviews and talking about it. The only other thing that is of current interest and that I think worth mentioning is that I now have a website, farfromthetree.com, which I started because people kept saying to me, we've met all these people in your book, but let me tell you my story. I've been getting an overwhelming 200 or 300 emails a day since the book came out, and a lot of them are from people who wanted to tell me their story, which relates somehow to stories in the book.
Ugh.
And I thought there should be a forum where people can actually talk to one another. So I've started that, and I'm hoping that listeners to this program and others will find their way there and will look at farfromthetree.com, and that it will become a place where people can meet and feel unalone.
Well, we will certainly link to that. I would love to hear more at a later date about you touched briefly in the introduction that you spoke to parents and families of sons and daughters who are HIV positive, and that's a whole different identity that we always want to give more attention to. So much more to talk about. But for now, folks, go to farfromthetree.com and log in there. And then, of course, go to andrewsolomon.com, and they can read more about you and find out what's coming up. What an absolute pleasure. To say that your work moves me, it's really an understatement. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's been a real treat for me.
Keep doing what you're doing, sir.
Shall do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, and we are back. I am not doing the news by myself this week. I am joined by...
Jody!
You have not been here in forever.
I know.
So let me ask some questions to make sure this is all going okay.
Okay.
Are you still gay?
Yes.
You know that you're on a radio show right now.
Yes.
And still interested in doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Then let's get started.
Okay.
There is a news story that is not being covered in the LGBT press, but one that I am throwing onto our show for this week. So, you know, they have these lottery winners. They have the big old mm-hmm. lottery, and people won many, many millions of dollars.
Yeah.
An Iowa couple, they won $202 million in the Powerball jackpot. What would you do with $202 million?
Many things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything gay?
Possibly. Probably some charitable donations in there.
Huh.
Yeah.
I would buy clothes. Okay, so... Which is pretty much what you just said. I just see Banana Republic as a charitable donation. I don't know if you agree or not. I sense that you agree. Good. So, this couple won $202 million, and one of the things that they're doing with the money is they're donating $3 million to their local high school, where their son goes to school.
Okay.
He's a sophomore in the school. And they're donating it to the high school so that they can build a brand new football stadium.
Okay.
Okay? With one stipulation.
Okay.
That the opposing team's locker room be painted pink. And I have a huge problem with this. So this is Mary, L-O-H-S-E. How would you say that? That's very...
L-O-H-S-E.
That's very Minnesotan. Lessa. Let's go with that.
Lessa.
Kind of like lefse.
A little bit.
Which is like a treat. That one might eat.
Yeah.
So Mary Lefse, who one half of the couple who won this money, she said, "I was sort of half joking and a half not, I suppose, but they said they'll do it. It's supposed to put them, the visitors, in a certain soft frame of mind. It will certainly give all the players something to talk about." I feel this is a gay story. I feel that this is blatant, just gender stereotypes.
It's a gender story, definitely.
We are saying that masculinity is mutually exclusive from pink.
Yeah.
And if you are embracing a color or exposed to a color that is not consistent with how men behave and is associated with femininity, then you will lose the football game.
Right.
This is messed up.
It's really messed up. There are other color studies out there, and I cannot quote where they're from, but I've definitely heard that there are certain colors that inspire certain feelings.
Yeah.
So I had heard that there is some shade of yellow that if you put it in places where there are large groups of people, that it can really be very irritating and angering.
Well, apparently this mimics the University of Iowa's visiting team locker room, which has a similar color scheme. So, yes, I have a problem.
I have a problem with that, too. I have a problem with that, too.
So we're going to move on from that story.
Yep.
Into,
yep.
I think I'm going to write about that, though, for my next Huffington Post piece. Because it's kind of a college story.
It is,
And an LGBT story. So look for that in the next couple days.
Yeah.
Over in Cameroon... We talk so much about Uganda, but things aren't so great over in Cameroon.
Mm.
As LGBT people here in the U.S. are debating marriage equality, you could send a text message in Cameroon and be jailed.
Oh, that's right. I did. I actually read about this.
I did not. I didn't hear about this until today.
Yeah.
An appeals court in Cameroon upheld Roger Jean-Claude Mbeder, I'm sure I mangled his name, his conviction for violating Cameroon's anti-gay laws. He sent a picture of himself holding a sign that read, "I'm very much in love with you," via text message to another man.
Mm-hmm.
He has already served half of a 3-year sentence. Can you imagine? When he was released from jail in July, unless the Cameroon Supreme Court throws out the appeals court ruling, he will be tossed back into jail to serve out the rest of his 3-year sentence for sending a text message. A text message. He said, he told the Associated Press by telephone, quote, "I'm going back to the dismal conditions that got me critically ill before I was temporarily released for medical reasons. I'm not sure I can put up with the anti-gay attacks and harassment I underwent at the hands of fellow inmates and prison authorities on account of my perceived and unproven sexual orientation. The judicial system in this country is just so unfair." Jody and I agree.
Completely.
We agree.
Completely.
So that's pretty... crazy.
It's
a text message.
A text message.
I would be serving a life sentence for some of the text messages I have sent this morning.
Yeah.
This morning. Yeah. That sounds really more salacious than I meant it to, but yeah. I'm just saying, that's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's terrible. I can't...
The update on Uganda, we will say the update on Uganda, is they did finish their... The parliament finished their session for the year, and they did not pass the anti-gay legislation, but activists there are saying, do not get your hopes up. This will come roaring back when the new season starts. Ugh. The new season. The new reality season of Uganda Parliament, anti-gay warriors. Ugh. Now, Nate Silver.
Yeah.
Do you know Nate Silver?
I want to say that the name is very familiar.
Yes. Nate Silver is the statistician who many are saying he is just the code breaker. He's the guy who predicted that President Obama would win.
Okay, okay.
And so Out Magazine just named him their person of the year.
Okay.
Which is kind of cool because he's, as my mother would say, a little nebbishy. He's, you know, he's like this nerdy guy. And so he's the person of the year.
Yeah.
So he, in this interview with Out Magazine, with Aaron Hicklin, who was on the show before, he talked about his sexual orientation. And this is what he said.
Okay.
He said, for me, I think the most important distinguishing characteristic is that I'm independent-minded. I'm sure that being gay encouraged the independent-mindedness, but that same independent-mindedness makes me a little bit skeptical of parts of gay culture, I suppose. Mm-hmm. My friends would describe me as sexually gay, but ethnically straight. Okay, and he goes on. Pointing to a series of flagpoles in Chicago's Boys Town District memorializing various gay Americans, he recalls, quote, there was one little plaque for Keith Haring, and it was like, Keith Haring, gay American artist. And I was like, why isn't he just an American artist? I don't want to be Nate Silver, gay statistician, any more than I want to be known as a white, half-Jewish statistician who lives in New York. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, you're being named the Person of the Year by Out Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So even in accepting that honor, and I would assume that he accepted that honor, you are taking on a little bit of that mantle of putting the word gay as a prime identifier in your resume.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out, and in a few weeks we have Matthew Breen, who's the editor-in-chief of The Advocate, is going to be on the show, and so I'm going to ask him about this as well. But this idea of being sexually gay but ethnically straight, there's some kernel of something in there that bugs the crud out of me. And I don't really know what it is, but anything there? Nothing irks you there?
It doesn't irk me there, because I definitely understand not being... not feeling like you identify with the predominant popular culture or the culture that is portrayed as being, this is gay culture.
Right.
That is the predominant view of, if you're gay, you obviously wear a pink.
Right.
Or if you're gay, you obviously are into go-go boys and going clubbing. Or if you're gay,
well,
you obviously...
That's true, though. That is true.
Not necessarily.
That is true. If you are gay, you are interested in going clubbing, and you have an affinity for go-go boys. That's that. There's research. I'm not even saying about... Now, I understand the whole being part of gay culture and resisting. And, I, you know, look, you even talk about the phrase gay culture, and what does that even mean?
Right.
So I get that part.
Yeah.
I have a problem with the fact that separate from gay culture... You self-determining, I do not want, this is where I want the word gay, this is where I don't want the word gay.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, he's accepting the accolade of Person of the Year without magazine.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He is taking on that mantle to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And part of being in the public eye is surrendering your ability, and this is where people might object, is surrendering your ability to decide which labels apply to you and which don't. And I think that when you willingly take on the mantle of a Person of the Year for Out Magazine, you don't then get to say, I don't want to be known as the gay statistician. You kind of, you know, I would assume you're taking it on because you want to be a role model for other people. And I challenge you right now to name another gay statistician.
I can't.
Yeah,
not
I thought,
that
by the
aware.
Way, I did just have a moment where I thought you were going to be able to rattle off four. Let me tell our listeners, if there's anyone who would have been able to respond and say, you know, name four gay statisticians, I think Jody is on that list. I feel like I could have said, Jody, name me four wolf-loving gay people, and you would just... that would take 2 seconds for you.
I can definitely name at least two.
Yeah, look at that. And yeah. I don't know that everybody could do that. So the point being is that you've accepted this honor of being Out Magazine's Person of the Year. I think that you want to be an inspiration, and I think Nate Silver is incredible, and I think he's a role model in such a different way than other people are role model. But then I don't like the idea of people reading this and him in some way saying, I don't know, I read this and feel like you're disavowing part of that. And
I also think it's sort of expressing a desire that wishing that it wasn't a deal, you know, that because straight folks who are remembered for doing great things do not also be, you know, you don't have Susan B. Anthony, straight women's voting rights activist.
Right, but it does say Susan B. Anthony, women's rights activist. Maybe that's not the best example for me. But the point being, it's important that we highlight when someone is of an underrepresented, at least in terms of voice, class. And so right now, yes, let's get to the point. If Nate Silver said, I want to get to the point where this word doesn't even come up, I understand that. Except that's not where we are right now.
Not yet. Although, maybe we will be.
Yeah.
Maybe we will be.
I hope we're not. I hope we're not. I love that part of my identity. I don't mean just because I know you love that part of your identity as well, and as do gay people everywhere. I love using that word as really the first word for me to describe myself. Now, I use the word gay before I use the word, and my God, isn't this an example of my own privilege, before I use the word white, before I use the word male, before I use the word Jewish. And I think all of those are indicative of my male white privilege. I don't know if Jewish privilege is really there. But I love the word I love putting the word gay first. That is like my word. And I also have a gay radio show.
Right.
And I am gay. I told you.
Really?
I know. So this is my coming out story. Now, but yeah, on episode 194 here of the show So Gay, I'm coming out. So, I don't know. I kind of get a little antsy when I read quotes like this. And you read stuff like this all the time. I don't want to be known as the gay singer-songwriter. Yes, except that so many of the youth, and I always trace it back to the youth, desperately need those examples. I want to be known as the gay selectman. I am the gay selectman. I'm the out gay selectman.
You are. You are.
And maybe that's the deal. Maybe it's the word out, because that makes a big difference. I don't know. I'm babbling on this. Now, we talked earlier in the show with Pulitzer Prize finalist Andrew Solomon about, because he's been on all the news shows talking about the Newtown tragedy in Connecticut. And, of course, it took no time for Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor Mike Huckabee, for the American Family Association's Brian Fisher, these folks to say, of course this tragedy happened because of America's progression in accepting the gays. Now, I'm going to make a distinction right now.
Okay.
I will cover this story, and I will not cover another story, even though by not covering the other story, and I'm going to mention it, I'm probably covering it. But so the American Family Association, Brian Fisher, he said, God is not going to go where he is not wanted. All these different quotes, I can't even read half of them. Focus on the Families, James Dobson, who, it's just fun to read his quotes because they're so ridiculous. Our country really does seem to be in complete disarray. I'm not talking politically. I'm not talking about the result of the November 6th election. I'm saying that something has gone wrong in America and that we have turned our back on God and all of these other things about being anti-gay. So that's what these folks are saying. Now, the Westboro Baptist Church.
God.
Right. But here's the thing. Why do we even cover it? This church, I'm covering this by not covering it, I know that, but they had announced on Twitter that they were going to protest the various funerals. Okay. The Westboro Baptist Church is an organization of, like, I don't know, 50, 60 people. There's really not that many of them. They're all related. They're all Phelpses. But their ability to gain press coverage, which I'm doing right this second, is unbelievable to me. And let's organize a counter protest. Let's do that. Why? I get it. But they're so counterculture. They lack support anywhere that the disproportionate amount of press that they're able to get and how they're able to get all of the gays riled up to say, we have to do something. I don't understand why we're still at this point. It's kind of like the KKK does not get the same press that it used to get.
Correct.
You don't read about the KKK. I can't believe I'm going here right now, but I think I have a point. We'll find out in a couple seconds. You don't read about the KKK is doing this, the KKK is doing that, and right. they are.
Right.
And yet the Phelps clan of the Westboro Baptist Church, they are able to send four people to a funeral, and the Huffington Post stories on it are shared thousands of times.
Right.
And I don't know how to break that cycle of giving them the attention, but isn't there some way to break that cycle of giving them the attention? It just fuels them.
It does. It does.
And we're doing it right now.
I know, by talking
because,
about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they listen to the show.
Yeah.
David Pakman. David Pakman of the David Pakman Show, who I enjoy immensely, but I question why David repeatedly has them on his show. And now David, I was reading on Facebook yesterday that he's trying to broker a deal between the Westboro Baptist Church members and some other people to have them not protest. And good for you, David, but I kind of feel like it gets him ratings.
Yeah.
And what if he just said, you know what, Shirley Phelps, who he has on all the time, mm-hmm. I'm actually not going to have you on the show anymore.
Yeah. What if?
I've never reached out to them to have them on the show.
Yeah.
That's not interesting to me. That's not the type of show we have.
No.
But I don't know.
I think we do have to stop paying so much attention.
We do.
We really do.
I don't like it. I don't like it. So there's that.
Yeah.
On to happier news, because there is a little bit of happier news. And I'm actually going to download this a little bit later today. There is now an app that you can get called the Pink Dollar app. And this was British entrepreneur Paul Ramskar created this new app that lets people know, here are gay-friendly businesses that you can go to. I would like to incorporate that into my life more. Like this morning, I will tell you, not at work, but at another time this morning, I needed a new pair of jeans and I ordered it from Banana Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at no point in my ordering the jeans from Banana Republic, the only criteria that went in was that I received a 30% coupon today. Mm-hmm. I don't know their LGBT friendly index rating score.
Right.
And they might be off the charts fantastic. I would hope that they are.
I would hope so.
But if they're not, and we'll provide the update a little bit later on, or probably on next week's show, if they're not, maybe I shouldn't be shopping there.
I'd also be curious if there could be more reporting from businesses where you're thinking of ordering from on other concerns, like having sort of the list of social things there so that you know who you're buying from. So I think that one's really important. I also think it's important to think about waste that they're putting into the environment,
right.
That they're treating their employees really well, which would tie into the LGBT stuff. So is it a good place to work for LGBT folks, but is it also just a good place to work in general?
Right.
You know, and what kinds of things do they support in their charitable giving? Like, I'd be really curious if there's a way that easily, and some businesses do this, but I don't think it's a majority yet, where you can check it out. Like, who is this business? Who are they? Not just their product. Who are they? Where is my money going?
I think that's really important. Now, I am looking up right now. It turns out that Gap, they are indeed very gay friendly.
Well, that's good.
So that's good. So I feel a little bit better.
Banana Republic, and they are pretty,
they're all
the same.
And I don't. There are places like I've never been. Oh, it's totally. I almost just lied on the show, and there's one guy who knows that was going to be a lie. So I'll out myself. I have once been to a Cracker Barrel.
Okay.
Have you been to a Cracker Barrel?
I have never.
I was down. I was going to Dollywood.
Yeah.
As naturally I would last summer, and we went to a Cracker Barrel. But I largely try to stay away from Cracker Barrel, and there's one in the area because they have this history of being anti-gay. And I do try, and I have failed, but I have certainly cut down on my Urban Outfitters purchases astronomically.
I don't go there ever anymore.
Astronomically, because they're not so gay-friendly, and they do some things.
There's a lot of things that they do
that
are not so good.
And surprisingly, that actually brings us to the end of our time here on this week's show.
Whoa.
So next week's show, we have all new shows. You think, oh, they're taking time off for the holidays and there's going to be repeats on. There's not going to be repeats on. Next week's show, we have NPR's Netta Ulaby, who...
Oh, she's great.
I just adore her.
Yeah.
I adore her. So she's going to be on the show, as well as comedian. I love having comedians on the show because they're funny. Robin Cloud will also be on next week's show.
Very cool.
And then the first show of the new year, Matthew Breen, the editor-in-chief of The Advocate, will be on our show. So that's very exciting.
Yeah.
And there'll be a new segment with Jody. Can you do it the first week of the new year?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
we're putting you on the spot. All right, so tune in for those shows. You can, of course, go to thisshowissogay.com and learn all about the fun things happening with our show, including our upcoming guests. Our 200th show is coming up real soon, which is a little bit nutty. Send us an email if you have an idea for guests for our 200th show. Send them. Send them to Ken at thisshowissogay, or if you want to say something critical about this week's show, you send that on over to Jody at thisshowissogay. I promise you that is a real address. And, of course, go to Facebook, join the thousands of people there who like us there, because we sure as heck like you. Have an amazing holiday. Relax. Get your energy back together so that you can use your voice to make a difference for all those people around you who are struggling to get their voices on the table. And remember, while you're doing all of those great things, why be gay when you can be so gay?
I worked so hard to make it every day.